Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. Today's interview is with Professor Josh Lerner of Harvard Business School, who was visiting London in January 2010 to speak at a conference on private equity and taking the opportunity to promote his new book, Boulevard of Broken Dreams, Why Public Efforts to Boost Entrepreneurship and Venture Capital Have Failed, and What to Do About It. One chapter in the book looks at sovereign wealth funds, and Josh began by speaking about the particular challenges facing this form of institutional investor.
When you think about sovereign wealth funds, they certainly have, in some sense, many of the same challenges that any other institutional investor, for instance, a university endowment or a pension fund would have. But at the same time, they've got an overlay of additional challenges, one of the most important of which is that they have sort of this mixed role in many cases. In many instances, they're being asked to, on the one hand, essentially serve as an endowment for the country. On the other hand, they're often asked to smooth out things. So if the markets go down, they may be asked to step into the markets and buy a bunch of equities to prop up prices. And perhaps, you know, the most extreme end, in many cases, they're also asked to serve as holding companies. In other words, the government has some entity, and they basically just hand it over to the sovereign wealth fund and say, put this in your portfolio as well. So that mixed array of challenges and the sort of different responsibilities that come with it certainly introduce a kind of opportunity, challenge, choose your word, in terms of their ability to generate investment success. You know, when you talk to many of the people who run who have run U.S. endowments for a number of years, they often will say, when we started, when it was just $1 billion, it was a lot easier running this endowment than it is today when it's $20 billion. And if you compare that to the challenges of running something which has got hundreds of billions of dollars, many hundreds of billions of dollars, clearly it becomes very, very challenging in it just by being large. When you think about it, you know, a lot of the strategies have been so successful for the university endowments in terms of choosing, you know, venture capital, you know, sort of esoteric, underdiscovered asset classes and so forth. You know, as you get bigger, it becomes harder and harder playing these strategies, which require a certain kind of deftness to them.
Next, we asked Josh about the possible challenge that sovereign wealth funds might face of trying to balance social goals with financial objectives.
It certainly is a challenge as well, because I think that certainly one of the things that you see is that the process of doing both these things at once can be very hard. I mean, there's a very clear bifurcation, for instance, in the rules governing foundations in the United States between the amount of money that the money that they have for programmatic purposes and the amount of money that they're the money that they have for investment purposes. And the idea is the funds for investment are supposed to be done with a clear eye towards generating financial returns. The worry is, of course, once you try to do both at the same time, you often end up in this case where you don't succeed in doing either very, very well. And certainly we can point to, you know, any number of cases where either sovereign funds were pushed into making, you know, socially targeted investments that weren't really very good investments and degraded the, you know, degraded the returns they had, or in some cases where they did make investments which ended up being ones that were counter to some of the broader political goals and were forced to unwind it. Just to name, you know, one example, the Norwegian Sovereign Fund had a couple of years ago made made a series of investments which were quite prescient, essentially going short a number of the Icelandic banks. And while that was clearly the right insight, ultimately, they were forced to essentially unwind that position in large part.
Josh had mentioned foundations as a way of separating social investment from returns-oriented investment. We asked him if that was a good model for sovereign wealth funds.
I think in an ideal world it is, but certainly one of the challenges they face is that in many cases there are a lot of influences at work. We have a study which looks at the performance of direct investments by sovereign funds. In other words, where they invest directly in companies, typically privately held companies. And what we find is there's a very dramatic demarcation between the sovereign funds, which are essentially where the political leaders of the country are involved on the investment committees of the sovereign funds, and those where they're not. And in particular, the ones where you essentially have that political involvement in the investment decision-making process itself, tend to do many more local investments. They tend to also invest disproportionately when the market is particularly high and then experience things going down afterwards. So it seems that they're investing locally and probably at exactly the wrong times, jumping in when it's really hot locally and really suffering as a result in terms of the kind of returns that they get.
Next, we turn to the potential threat of corruption.
And so certainly, I mean, this has been a challenge that I think awaits. I mean, there's certainly public pension funds have struggled with too, which is that when he has a large pot of money, there is sort of a temptation to use it for various kinds of purposes, like investing in companies which are, you know, as happened for the Norwegian experience during the 1970s, for instance, where a lot of the money ended up being invested in friends and families of, you know, various parliamentarians and various other things along those lines. We've seen some of the same pressures in terms of the U.S. state pension funds as well. And clearly that again is a danger which having the sort of more arm's length structure with real independence and autonomy for the investment committee members, I think certainly that can alleviate or limit some of those pressures.
In his book, Josh provides a series of guidelines, do's and don'ts for policymakers who want to facilitate entrepreneurship, as well as some examples of successes and failures. We asked him about successes and failures among sovereign wealth funds, and in particular about Dubai.
You know, certainly there are any number of examples you could point out of groups that have done things in extremely, you know, professional, institutionalized kind of manner. And I think you could point to a group like the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority as an example of a group which is just, you know, sort of put an enormous amount of effort into, you know, doing things right and investing in the kind of infrastructure they need to be, you know, very successful. Mm. On the other hand, you know, there are, you know, any number of examples, and this is not just an emerging market kind of thing. If you look at the Alaska Permanent Reserve Fund as an example, you'll see that the oversight body seems to be packed with Sarah Palin's cronies and so forth, where it seems that there hasn't been this sort of effort to really professionalize the investment decision-making process, and the results have suffered as accordingly. Clearly, Dubai is an interesting case. There's clearly been a whole series of public investments done there, some of which have been internal, which have been spectacularly successful, you know, sort of all going all the way back to dredging the river in the 50s to, you know, sort of building the port in the 1970s. I mean, and over the years, there's certainly been an enormous amount of, you know, essentially public venture capital that's been very successful. But it's also clear that in the last few years, in many senses, one saw that there were a lot of people running around with at least implicit public guarantees doing projects where it's not clear there was either the same social benefit than dredging a river or making a port would have, and where certainly it seems there was an absence of the kind of checks and balances which, you know, sort of lent to, you know, the sort of real estate explosion and all the issues that followed from that.
Next, we talked about the potential of alternative asset classes such as real estate and private equity, and lessons from the recent investment performance of the Ivy League university endowments.
I guess I would say that it's both an opportunity and a challenge, which is to say that in some sense, when you look at the success that endowments and other sophisticated institutional investors have, that has largely stemmed from alternative investments. When you look at the outperformance in terms of, you know, the Ivy League schools, for instance, over the last decade, which has been really spectacular, the share of it that was accounted for by stocks and bonds was tiny. Essentially, almost all the outperformance was being driven by real estate, hedge funds, and private equity. So I think it's completely plausible and completely understandable why sovereign funds would be interested in doing it. The challenge is that, you know, sort of deploying that much money, in many cases with very large funds, in an intelligent, deliberate kind of way can be very, very challenging. And I think that in many cases, either they need to, you know, sort of experiment with various kinds of organizational structures, like, you know, breaking things into different pieces so it's a little more compartmentalized and entrepreneurial, to the idea of just simply, you know, relying on intermediaries to help them some way the process, not because they need to get big, but actually because they need to get small. That playing the venture game by themselves is probably going to be hard to do for most of them. So perhaps by using intermediaries, they can address some of those issues.
Right.
You know, the Ivy schools in general had had, you know, tremendous success, and then have had, you know, a lot of reversals in terms of stuff in the last few years. I mean, last year and a half. Now, I guess you can still say, compared to where, you know, the outperformance they had for the 90s and much of the 2000s is such that, you know, the correction that they've suffered, you know, is such that they're still, you know, far ahead, especially because we know that had they just simply held stocks and bonds, let's say a 60% stocks and 40% bonds, they still would have been hammered right. in 2008. In any case, I think the bigger challenge, or certainly one of the challenges, has been that, you know, I don't think that in many cases the endowments necessarily appreciated by putting so much investments in illiquid assets, how much of a headache it would cause if there was this kind of freezing up or liquidity crisis. I think a lot of people had in mind, you know, saying, well, you know, had in mind a sort of scenario like that in the 1987, when you essentially had a blip, and you know, not only was there illiquidity in terms of private stuff, but also there was a lot of illiquidity even in terms, I mean, even IBM was trading with a bid-ask spread on that, you know, that Monday of the crash out of like with $40.
Yeah.
So there, you know, essentially you couldn't run anywhere to get liquidity. But something like here, where essentially the public stuff has sort of remained more or less liquid, but the private stuff, the liquidity is really dried up. And I don't think that was a situation that, you know, many of the endowments had really fully anticipated. And I suspect going forward, they'll be, you know, somewhat more cautious in terms of the share they devote to illiquid assets.
Finally, we talked about public perceptions of sovereign wealth funds and the political debates surrounding them, particularly around the lack of transparency of many of these investment vehicles.
Well, I mean, I think there certainly are a set of issues there. That's clearly one of them. Another issue is just, even in terms of investment success, being transparent is not necessarily the way you want to go. So I think that if you look, for instance, at the, the experience of some of the endowments, you know, essentially their decision to go and invest in a venture group or a private equity group leads to a flood of people just saying, oh, those guys are investing in it.
Right.
They must be smart. Let's go and throw money at it.
Right.
And as a result, the groups they select end up having this flood of money getting much larger than right. made sense and so forth. So in a way, you know, sort of given the sort of nature of a market, which seems to have an important element of me-tooism to it,
yeah.
having some sort of degree of a little bit of veil around specific issues is not necessarily an all bad thing. I mean, I think the other issue which clearly is out there is that there are a lot of misconceptions about sovereign funds. So I think that if you were to go, for instance, the typical U.S. congressman, they would say, oh, sovereign funds are basically all about buying up U.S. critical technologies and transferring all the knowledge back to them. Well, at least not perhaps every congressman, but certainly a number of them would feel that way. But in point of fact, you know, most of the sovereign funds investments have been in emerging economies rather than in the developed nations. They've tended to shy away from high tech and other sort of more strategic industries and focus more on, you know, more traditional investments. Furthermore, when you look at the, you know, the performance of the companies that get these investments by sovereign funds, if it was all about technology stealing and so forth, you'd think that would be bad news and the stock price would go down. Instead, typically when sovereign funds invest, the stock price goes up, and when they sell, it goes down. So, you know, there's also this issue around addressing misconceptions that are out there in terms of what these organizations are and what their implications are.